Hey everyone, this is Connor here, and on today's episode, we sit down with Nikita Capatun from Juniper. Nikita has one of the coolest stories that we've heard yet, where he went from dreams of being a professional ballet dancer to studying physics at university to eventually deciding that he wanted to go all in on being an entrepreneur. And that is when he decided that he was going to go and start Juniper, which is actually on track to hit over $65 million this year alone. So on today's episode, we discuss a few things like how Juniper got started and grew to where it is today, how Nikita approaches learning new things, how he got out of a depressive state, and things that he does on a daily basis to continue staying happy and being happy, and a whole lot more. So with all that out of the way, I really hope that you guys enjoyed today's episode. You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast.
Weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Today we are greeted with Nikita. Nikita, how are you today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for coming on. So for anyone listening right now who really doesn't know much about your background or what Juniper is, could you spend 30 seconds introducing yourself and letting people know who you are and what the company is that you're running today?
Yeah, totally. So quick background before the company. I grew up as a training to become a ballet dancer, but that was sort of thwarted, 18, 19 years old when I had an injury to my knees. So switched pretty quickly to school, where I went to Queen's University up in Canada and studied engineering physics there. Decided pretty quickly I didn't want to sort of go down that path either. It was mostly sort of a PhD future for me, and decided instead I wanted to run a company instead. And that brought me to Juniper, which I run today. And so I co-founded Juniper back in 2016. We're a premium merchandising solution for the world's largest influencers. We've grown for the past 4 or 5 years to now about having 60, 65 people on the team. And we were fortunate to do about $30 million in revenue last year. So hopefully a quick 30-second run through of everything.
Yeah, that was an awesome background. And so I want to kind of start things out in the earlier days too, right? Right now you fast forward and you're in this super successful position. You're running, you're employing 65 people. You're doing millions of dollars a year in sales. But when we spoke last week on the phone, you didn't always want to be an entrepreneur. And that's actually something that's pretty different about you compared to a lot of the people that we speak with on this podcast. You know, part of the podcast is you have people who are in their 20s and they want to do entrepreneurship. And like they've known since they were 13, this is the path that I want to go down. But your dreams were to be like a professional ballet dancer?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I'm curious like what your ambitions were for that. And I guess, how your mindset shifted as you grew up and as you kind of like progressed and got that injury.
Yeah, definitely. So, I grew up in this, small city in Canada called Winnipeg, and for whatever reason, there is probably one of the most well-known ballet schools in North America situated there, which is quite odd, but, you know, made for a nice, transition in my teen years. But yeah, my Eastern European parents put me into it. And yeah, spent about 7-8 years training professionally there. At first I hated it. Was the last thing I wanted to do, but my mom said like, hey, give it 6 months, let's see what happens. And I was about 10 at the time, so I didn't even know what life was, but got into it and yeah, met a really, really cool group of people that yeah, had a similar, well, I think they knew what they wanted to do before I did, which was yeah, to become prima ballerinas and principal ballet dancers. But so I kind of tagged along for a bit and then joined them in that dream. So yeah, trained professionally for 7-8 years, did about like 6-7 hours of dance a day, 6 days a week, was wow. Pretty wild, especially for teenage years, just kind of a crazy schedule in that sense. Dreams got crushed at 17, 18 because of, I contracted tendonitis in both of my knees. And the only way to really fix tendonitis is to just stop what you're doing, essentially. I got that unfortunate news. I still kind of stuck with it for another year, thinking that it might get better. Again, not knowing what else there was to life. And after that, it just was clear like this was not getting better. So stopped there and just started shifting towards thinking about what else could I start to do in my life. What other, you know, dreams and ambitions do others have? And I attached myself to my dad at first, who's a math professor, and that's hence my sort of, you know, jump into engineering and physics and such. But then shortly after, sort of decided, okay, well, that even doesn't make sense for me either. There's something much more grandiose than that.
And what was that transition like when you decided, okay, I want to focus on starting a business, starting a company? What was the next step there? Were you kind of just playing around with any ideas? Did you have ones that you're working on trying to scale? Was it try everything and see what sticks? What did that look like?
Yeah. So I think the first time I even was introduced to the concept of entrepreneurship was this program I jumped into called the Cansbridge Fellowship back in 2015, which is in my third year of university. Very much sort of, you know, it doesn't seem like an entrepreneurial program at first. We basically had 15 kids from across Canada on a yearly basis go to China or go to Asia and sort of find work there. And they kind of branded it as an entrepreneurship program, though I didn't really fully understand why at first, but totally got it when I got there. The feeling I had, or the best way to summarize that summer, was that I came out of it feeling like the world was a playground, essentially. You just have this totally new, you know, sense of what others are doing in the world, of what you could do in the world. And it kind of takes removing yourself from where you're living in that moment. And that's, in particular, I actually lived in a small university town of Kingston. That's where Queen's University is situated. And there's really, it's like a student town. There's like 50,000 of us and that's it. So in itself, it was already a bubble. And so removing myself from that and going to the other side of the world just made me feel like, wow, like I could do kind of anything, right? And there were many others in that program also thinking about like, okay, what could I do? What's sort of the peak of potential I could hit? And a lot of us landed on starting a business. So I can get into the story of like how Juniper was started, but yeah, that's sort of my sense of, or the shift I saw that really got me excited about doing something bigger than what I thought I could do at the time.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs do have one moment in their life when they start thinking that way. Like, I know, like, I remember, maybe this is probably a dumb example, but like, I specifically remember watching the Steve Jobs movie, and you hear that Steve Jobs quote where it's like, you know, everything around you in this thing we call life was made up by people who are no smarter than you, and like, you can change it, you can influence it. And I'm like, you start thinking about things, and you're like, okay, I live in this country that has laws, but like, the laws were invented by like people like me. You know, like, we have these things called cars that were invented by like people like me, like this entire cities. And I feel like once you start like realizing that a lot of the stuff around you is influenceable and that it's not just the way it is, you kind of get this huge different perspective on life. And I feel like, to your point, like, it sounds like a lot of your peer group wanted to go and start a business. And usually I would also make the argument that business is typically one of the better ways to go and influence a lot of these things, just purely based on incentives and the ability to go and transform things.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, for my first two summers, I essentially did research. I worked at the University of Manitoba for a summer, and then at Queen's University for the next summer, and was excited about doing big things. And I thought research was it, you know, like, I can maybe work towards, you know, getting my PhD one day and winning a Nobel Prize or something, right? But I found myself just like stuck in a basement, you know, in one of the department buildings. And like, it was just so slow moving. I was surrounded by a bunch of professors, very, very intelligent people. But for example, we had one of the machines I was using, it was a detector for dark matter, and it essentially just like stopped working 1 month. That was kind of it. The whole department was like, cool, like, I guess we got to like chill for a month or two and then we'll get back into it. And I was just like, this is so slow moving. There's little chance to like really make any impact. And I was hungry for more.
And then Juniper wasn't your first business venture though, right? You had started something previously?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't call it a business. Well, I wouldn't call it a successful business, but yeah, it was a great sort of foray into the entrepreneurship world. So I started this company called Connectivate, which, as I mentioned to you guys previously, is an awful, awful name for it. Decided Connect and Innovate put together would make for a cool name. But it was great. Like the, you know, I was looking around at the problems we had at Queens, and a lot of my peers were struggling with applying for jobs because they had no experience at the time. Kind of the classic catch-22 problem of, you know, how do you get a job if you didn't have a job in the past? And further, because we lived in this small university town, we saw a lot of businesses, like local mom and pop shops, that I guess we didn't understand their needs as much at the time, but we felt like, well, okay, they probably aren't doing as good of a job as they could be in marketing their services, in selling themselves, in getting themselves online, and building technology and such. And so our solution to that was to build a platform where we essentially connected the two, students and businesses, over short-term projects. And as simple as a concept as that. And it worked quite well as our sort of third, fourth year project. I think we generated like 15, 20 grand in sales in our first year. And then we kind of left it to a team to run with for a couple of years after that. And it went up to like 50, 60,000 or something. So again, not like phenomenal, mind-blowing numbers by any means, but an awesome foray into that world. And we had a small team of, you know, 5-10 people working with us, which is cool to even start flexing the leadership muscles a bit, you know, and see kind of what that felt like.
I think that's definitely a commonality among, I think, everyone we've spoken to, is that their first venture, like they've tried a million things. The first ones are never really anywhere near as successful as their other ones, but it's kind of that repetition of, okay, you know, let's start something, try it out. It works, doesn't work, and kind of keep going down that route. So yeah, how did Juniper now extend out of this? So you realize you didn't want to do Connectivate anymore. Wasn't what you were looking for. And then this is kind of where your brother gets involved a little bit as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. I decided to do this entrepreneurship program after university, and basically decided at the beginning of fourth year, like, hey, I'm not going to recruit at all, you know, coming out of university or for this year. Typically, you sort of start recruiting in August, September of the previous year to get a job.
Did you get any pushback when you decided that, or was that kind of just an internal decision, or had you talked to people about, you know, I'm not going to go get a job?
Yeah, I was pretty set on it. I had this one other, at the time he was more so of a mentor. He's actually a friend now, he's living upstairs. But he had done both programs, like this Cansbridge one where he went off to Asia as well, and this entrepreneurship program. And he sort of like was 2 years ahead of me and built out this roadmap for me in my mind, where I was like, cool, if he can like start a business in this entrepreneurship thing, and if he can be super successful with it, like certainly can I. And so mostly followed in his footsteps, which, back to the, you know, topic of shitty business ideas, we ended up building I like calling it a 2D printer, which was,
a printer?
It was just a printer, but like not just any printer, the best printer.
Of course.
We liked what Nest did with the thermostats, and really thought, okay, well, this printer, this like shitty, you know, appliance that you have that like rarely works, setup is awful, et cetera, et cetera. The experience is just awful. We thought, cool, like we could bring this into the 21st century and built a prototype for it. But like, the reason we even had that idea was because my buddy built a 3D printer and his 3D printing company was taking off. So I just follow in people's footsteps. I'm just a sheep, I guess.
Yeah. The guy running his own company and the millions of dollars is just a sheep. I do think, though, for what it's worth, like adding a nice design onto an outdated piece of technology, like a printer, is absolutely a great business model. Like I guarantee you, like, take your skills of what you have today, especially from the manufacturing side these days. I bet you if you did that same exact business today, knowing what you know now, you can easily go and make that, you know, $100 million business if you put the time into it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't invest in you know, the printer business today, knowing what, sure, I know.
Yeah,
but
people are, yeah,
but
people aren't
printing, I totally as much. Agree. Yeah, no, 100%. Like, I think a lot of fantastic businesses take sort of old industries and, yeah, bring a modern spin to them, and they find huge success with that.
So in terms of actually starting Juniper now.
Yeah. Sorry. Started this program out. And I remember on the first weekend, they wanted to have sort of this mock like entrepreneurship competition of some sorts. And so they basically gave us like 72 hours to, work with our team, come up with some ideas and pitch, something at the end. And I remember like sitting at home, trying to come up with ideas, thinking about all the different things we could do. And actually, I had recently read 4-Hour Workweek and loved the book, thought it was fantastic, and recalled, what Tim was talking about, which was sort of, before you even decide what kind of product you should be selling, you should really, really understand your audience first, basically. What's your target market? Figure that out first, and then you'll find the series of products you want to make for it. And that really struck me, and I was thinking a lot about that and about pre-existing audience bases and such. And my brother at the time was starting his YouTube career, so that was certainly top of mind. And I just had this eureka moment. I'm like, oh my God, like these guys spend 100% of their time building their own audience base, right? Like they're creating content on a day-to-day basis. They're trying to build their own brand and they have that existing audience base. I've answered Tim's question, and so fantastic. Like, I can go and figure out what products to sell to them now. So it was a very sort of like simple starting idea. I immediately kind of worked with my brother on that and sort of started helping him explore what the market looked like overall. And he had a similar feeling. He was about 10,000 subscribers, I think, at the time when we first started sort of helping each other out. Not huge, but certainly not small, right? Like kind of getting started in the space. And he was also like, cool, like I would love to get my brand into product.
And he was in the gaming space, right? Like he was live streaming a bunch of stuff like that.
Yeah. I think he was playing a bunch of different games at the time, but Roblox was sort of his niche at the time that he was focusing on. I was helping him explore what was out there, and he saw basically that the only solutions to building product was print on demand solutions. So essentially the concept is, you don't hold the inventory at all. You kind of pay this other company to, whenever a customer kind of places an order at your store, they take your design, stamp it on the t-shirt or hoodie or mug or whatever can be printed on, and then, ship to the customer base. And that was fine. Like there's a lot of pros to that overall. First off, you don't have to have any inventory. There's no inventory risk. You can get started pretty quickly, etc. But yeah, my brother was creating this universe of characters in Roblox, where he had this like cat best friend that sat on his shoulder, and a antagonist dog character, and just a whole bunch of characters in this like universe of IP he was creating. And it just didn't make sense at all to put that on a two-dimensional design and toss it on some mugs and then ship it to his fans, So we started thinking about, okay, what is it that's different that we could do here? And given that I'd lived in China literally just the year prior and had built connections through my network there and such, we immediately thought like, cool, well, let's at least test launching like a truly custom product that's aligned well with what he was building and what his content was. And so the first product we launched was a plush toy of literally his best friend cat that sat on his shoulder, which we had no idea how it was gonna go. We're like, oh, plush toys, that's a bit weird. But the first day we launched it, I think it sold like 15 grand in sales, which gave us at least the foundation to understand, cool, there's a business here and we can go after it.
And the cool part about that is like, take that, compare that to Connectivate, right? Like the business that you guys were hustling on at the end of college. And you quickly realize, like, I think we had the same exact conversation last week where you know that an idea is working and that an idea is good with how easy it is to go and make money off of that first day. And that's not always true, right? Like sometimes you literally just have to go and beat down a bunch of doors, especially if it's like a really novel idea, convince people that it's a good thing. But with something like this, it's like, okay, we made a product that was different from, hey, buy my t-shirt. We put it on a channel that we already know has a loyal following and a loyal subscriber base. and it sold out instantly, right? And so I'm guessing, like, at this point, it's kind of when the light bulb went off in your head of, like, wait a second, like, there's a lot of other opportunity to do this across all of the other YouTubers on the channel.
100%, yeah. And you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, you, like, spend, you know, months and years working on your first business, and it's like, you know, I'm still proud and happy of what we did with Connectivate, but it's to have in, like, one day the sales you had in months is just mind-boggling. So yeah, we were super happy with it.
As soon as those sales came in, did you instantly know, like, okay, we're gonna double down and do everything we can to scale this out as fast as possible? Or was there a bit of hesitation there with, you know, is this scalable? Was this a one-time occurrence? And how did you make that decision on, you know, let's dive in and give it 100%?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were very bullish on the business for sure. Hesitant. There were very good indicators for sure. I think still hesitant because, you know, we've launched one product, we've had success here. Who knows what will happen? I think what kept me still very bullish on not even that business, but just, like, entrepreneurship in general, was the fact that I said, hey, like, I'm just doing this after university. And so, like, I didn't give myself any particular period of time, like a cutoff date or anything, but probably, like, if I did this for a year or two and it, like, really wasn't working out, maybe I'd consider something else. But yeah, certainly, like, the moment we saw dollar signs in a particular direction, I was like full in, like, let's go as hard as we can here.
Nice. What happened next? So you guys, this worked, decided to scale it. Was it develop more products that kind of functioned along your brother's brand? Did you instantly try to get every influencer you can online, or because I feel like there's so many directions too that you could take. How did you figure out what the right one was, or maybe not even the right, or how did you figure out what the wrong ones were to keep scaling it out?
Yeah. So, I mean, first goal after that was like, okay, you have your first customer, like, are there more out there, you know? Thankfully, Dennis, that's my brother's name, his buddies were also getting into the YouTube world as well. And they were probably a quarter of his size at the time, but we still had no concept of what made for a very, you know, powerful YouTuber versus not. And so, you know, all we saw actually, which were pretty incredible numbers, were that these guys were, you know, generating 5, 10, 15 million views per month, something like that. And you just do some, like, really easy classic e-commerce conversions on that, even like 1% of 1%. And you're like, wow, like, we're selling a ton here. So we're like, yeah, okay, this probably works. Let's go after this. And rolled it out to them, which weirdly enough, it did work across all of them. But that first year in 2017, we were of the three, like, amigos, my brother and his two friends, like, we won with those, but we lost with dozens and dozens and dozens of others. We spent that whole year just testing and trying to work with different influencers from a whole range of different sizes. So all the way down to, like, 100,000 subscribers to multi-million subscribers, thinking that, okay, just obviously the bigger multi-million subscriber guys would sell the most and generate the most revenue and such. But yeah, like, just a huge trial and error process that we struggled through. And it probably took, like, if knowing what I know now, I think we would have been able to come to the conclusions that we did in a much faster period of time. But yeah, we the main things we started seeing that really, you know, I guess allowed us to forecast if a brand was going to do well or not was, what is the viewership of these guys? So not even subscribers, you could have a 100,000 subscribers sell out a million subscriber channel simply because of the viewers coming to the channel, somewhat obvious. You're looking at the engagement of that channel, so comments, likes, etc. And then the third, like, biggest thing, and there's many others, is, like, merchandisability and brand. So this is more of an X factor that you can't really objectively, you know, sort of determine, right? Or you can't, like, easily run it through a model. But yeah, like, what is this channel actually? Like, what is the brand here overall? And is there a brand? You could even have, like, a very highly engaged channel with a lot of viewers coming into it, but people don't actually look to it as a brand that they have like an emotional connection with at all. Instead, it's just like, oh, I enjoy this content. I, you know, will maybe jump on for like a minute or two to sort of see what's going on and leave. And that that's just taken, I think, honestly, years of refinement to even understand what is a super merchandisable brand versus not.
That's really cool. I feel like I gotta imagine that like the actual channel host / personality is a huge factor in that as well. Cause like I can think about it, right? If you think about it from like a health and fitness standpoint, you can go and take like a fitness influencer on YouTube who you see their face every day, you know, you see their body, their abs, whatever like that. You're like, okay, like that guy's the man. And he just launches, you know, a whole set of exercise bands or whatever. Maybe I want to go and buy that person's exercise bands. But if you take the same channel with the same amount of subscribers, engagement, and viewership, but instead of that one person launching this exercise brand business, it's now like, you know, their channel's content is all about like infographics and like the data behind, you know, all of these like muscle movements and exercises and working out. And you quickly realize like, hey, they're not going to sell as well because you don't have this like emotional connection with that person. Like it's not necessarily like, it's kind of like buying from reading a book versus buying from like watching an infomercial is almost the difference in something like that.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, like back to Tim's whole thing, you have to understand like what this audience is in the first place. You could, for example, like not that we do much work on Instagram, but you could look at it, famous female Instagrammer and be like, wow, like she's got millions and millions of followers, millions and millions of engaged users. That's fantastic. And you're like, okay, well, the perfect brand could be sort of some female fitness brand and such. And then you come to understand that actually 80 to 90% of her audience base is male. Right. Right. So it's, you really have to come to understand all of that before you start working with someone.
And to put a timeline on some of this is kind of like the end of 2016, 2017, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And within that though, so you trying a bunch of stuff that's working and not working, you guys still did really well that first year, right? I mean, you still sold a ton of products.
We did, and I'd love to take all the credit for it, but I'd say really the success of 2017 was understanding who we wanted to work with. We did generate, I think it was about 2.5 or 2.7 mil in revenue that year, which was fantastic. But that came from 5-6, you know, content creators max. And sure. Honestly, my brother still very much carried the business at the time. So while we had a lot of success from a revenue perspective, I was still like, oh my God, this is still like a me and my brother business, you know? So we still had a lot more to figure out.
So then what happened in 2018? Because I remember when we spoke before, there was a lot of different phases in the business, right? So if you take that first year and it's the, hey, let's go get proof of concept and let's go and narrow the funnel down on who our target market is, right? You check that box in 2017 and to some degree, maybe you're still iterating on that, but you have a good basis to what you want to go from there. What did 2018 look like?
Yeah, so on top of understanding who our target market was, we really started to understand like what our core value proposition was and what our wedge in the market was that, you know, we did better and different than anyone else. And at the time and still today, it's our like custom product development offering and infrastructure, which I can touch on more later. But basically what's really compelling about Juniper is that we can make any product that we want to, and like very quickly, affordably, et cetera. Like we can pump out completely custom products that we've never made before in a matter of a couple of weeks.
Can you give some examples of that? Because I think like most people, when they think about products that influencers are selling, like my mind immediately goes to, okay, I'm using a fitness example again, like, hey, I'm going to go and sell my own line of supplements, or you can jump to a model or something like that. And she says like, hey, I just launched like a whole line of t-shirts, and that stuff's pretty common. Can you give some like the crazier examples of like types of merchandise that you guys have made for different influencers and YouTubers?
Yeah, totally. So, I'd call sort of apparel, the first tier of products, right? As you just mentioned, Connor. So, yeah, t-shirts, hoodies, et cetera, like that's super common. And you can actually get that off of a print-on-demand infrastructure. But yeah, we've extended ourselves to build plush toys, to build figurines, to build subscription boxes that have like a whole myriad of different types of unique items inside. We've built board games in the past as well. Really, that's we're cool. Just completely driven by what the brand is and what it needs. And then we work backwards to figure out what are the products that actually make sense to launch for these guys.
That's awesome.
And then during 2018 is also when you had a lot of factory visits, right? Because you can't do any of this stuff without having a phenomenal team in place on the ground in China as well. As Connor and I can definitely attest to, it is, yeah, you're at an entirely different scale that we were at. But even then, like, it's not just ordering products online and getting them in. And especially at the timeline, how quickly you guys are turning around some of these ideas. So it was a lot of that put in place around that 2018 timeframe. You're building out the team, you're getting the people there, you're traveling to all these factories.
Yeah. And before I answer that, did you guys actually ever travel to China for Cardly? Or were you ordering everything online?
We had gone to Hong Kong a couple times. I think Connor went to mainland China a few times as well.
Guangzhou and Shanghai.
Super cool. Yeah, awesome.
We decided that going to the trade shows in Hong Kong for a weekend in between classes was a good idea for like
bad idea.
3 years in a row.
48 hours on land and 32 hours of flights was not the way to structure those kind of trips.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, no, it was tough on us, but we went for 3 weeks. So right. I guess tough in a different way, but yeah, no, it was a huge struggle. I was very thankful to have lived in China the year prior, not for too long, like 4 or 5 months, but I at least understood the culture decently well, or as well as you could in sort of 4 or 5 months, and felt just comfortable there in general. But yeah, no, like, we were essentially, we had been able to sort of work and operate with a third party company up until that moment, but it was super, super important for us to not just be reliant on this one company and for us to start building sort of our own IP and infrastructure in China, hence the decision to go there in the first place. And it was so tough. Like it really felt like we were doing everything completely from scratch, where we didn't even have like Chinese guidance at the time. It was essentially just two white boys, you know, traveling around from factory to factory and warehouse and warehouse, just trying to put the pieces together and figure out like how the hell does this system work, you know? And yeah, like you find that,
sorry, I was gonna say, like the crazy part about that too is like for a lot of these factories, you can be having a full-fledged conversation with someone like that on the internet, and they can show you photos of the factory. They can even take you to the factory, and then you can realize, like, months later, you've been dealing with a middleman this entire time. Did that happen to you guys a lot, or was that just our own bad luck?
Certainly, yeah, a bit. Like, that's why we went there first, and, like, we didn't even create too many connections prior to going, because I think we knew that, yes, like, there could be a whole chain of middlemen along the way, and so we decided to go there. But even when we were there, and we were meeting with people that sort of sold themselves as factories, we found out like over tea, oh wow, these guys aren't the factory owners, they're just someone in the middle of it all.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good jobber.
Yeah. And yeah, those days were tough. Like you spend like literally the whole day, 10 hours just going from factory to factory, and they're not all beside each other, you know, like they're an hour or two like between each other, like minimum. And it's like we went you know, in the summer to Shenzhen. It was like 35 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but just super hot. Yeah. All you wanted to do was just like crawl in bed at night with an ice cream and just sort of cry yourself to sleep. The other funny thing is just like what constitutes a factory completely changed in my mind. Before going, you kind of assume that you sort of imagine like Foxconn or something, right? Like this whole line of people putting products or pieces into a product together. And it's like super well oiled and just this like beautiful engine that creates products. We went and found like met with some factories where it was like three women sitting at a table sewing some plush toys together. Yeah. You know, like anyone can start a factory apparently.
I gotta imagine too, for you guys, it must have been absolutely brutal, because I think what starts making the supply chain a little bit easier is when you start dealing with the same materials. If you guys are going from plush toys to apparel to like figurines or like any kind of hard materials, now you're dealing with all different types of factories. And like, you know, you'll have, I remember when I was over there, I was in some factory that made a bunch of like resin figurines and ceramics and stuff like that. And you basically have one room up at the top where they have their highest skilled, highest paid labor. And these people are basically carving out the molds like by hand, doing all of this like really good artwork by hand. And then you go downstairs and you basically have just people in this factory who are like pouring in all of the raw materials, throwing it into a kiln or whatever it needs to be going and fired up. And then like you have people touching it up and painting it. But like, it's a lot by hand, like very, very few, you know, Model T Ford assembly lines, maybe a little bit more in the electronic stages of some of the factories. But a lot of the things that you know and think are, oh, you know, this must be totally automated, is actually just done by hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just even seeing how a plush toy gets stuffed with this like massive stuffing machine was quite cool. But no, like you, I mean, it's, but it's also quite amazing in its own way too, you know. Like you, yeah, like you'll enter a factory floor and you just see like hundreds and hundreds of people that like work extremely hard and that have like mastered this craft of building these products for decades now. And it's yeah, I don't know, like I think whenever you're away from it, you imagine it to be this just like black box, like in goes material, outcomes product or something. But it's really amazing to see sort of hard work and dedication of the Chinese people there.
What's changed now from when you guys were over in China trying to find factories? I'm assuming you like entirely different scale, but you've just kind of built off of that same foundation. I'm assuming you probably have a factory that could do any, you know, every product imaginable, or at least you have people on the ground that can figure that out. What were some of the big kind of turning points in that transition to really, you know, scaling this out to a consistent basis where you can get quality products, you can get them shipped? You know, was it the team there, or was there anything in particular you could point to?
Yeah, I mean, it actually didn't move as quickly as we wanted it to. We went back individually, my partner and I, probably 3 or 4 times to check in on things, meet new partners and try to figure stuff out. Because as you said, yeah, it's complex. It's not like we were looking to make a single item and just replicate that, right? Like where you're going there to kind of build an infrastructure. Like we want to be able to make any product. How do we go about doing that? And so, yeah, we started with one person full-time that worked there, brought that up to 2 eventually, realized that they weren't even the people we should be working with. So I had to almost start from scratch. So it's super messy. Like I wish it was as simple as just saying, oh, we went and figured it out and it's, you know, scaled to 30, 40 people from there. But no, yeah, like it was very, very slow moving. We eventually found this one woman, Luna, who was fantastic and basically did a third of the business that our like third party company was doing, but completely on her own, whereas they were sort of like a 20-person company. And she really helped sort of lay the foundation for things and just like get our system up and running. And we're now at like full-time Juniper people, I think around 6-7 people now. But when we now look at our like broader array of partners and such that are like full-time dedicated to Juniper work, we're sitting at about, yeah, like 30-40 people probably today. And you know, the factory partnerships from there are probably sort of in the like 50-60 plus range. So but it's amazing, like we can give them a product now, a completely new product they haven't made before, and a design for it, and literally within, you know, a day or two come up with a factory relationship, and then within a week or two come up with a completely novel sample for it. Which is just amazing. From a sales perspective, we can actually give people the sample of their items, like very custom items, within a couple of weeks. And then even for just regular product development and launching, it's just, we've been able to create this very lean system that has allowed us to jump onto different trends and such. Like I remember back when fidget spinners were a big thing in 2017, that was a huge thing. We like, it happened all of a sudden. Fidget spinners were everywhere, and like within a week we had our own fidget spinners up and going. Yeah. So it's an incredible system, and we're very proud to have it.
Yeah, I feel like you guys are really a product design and supply chain company focusing on influencers, because I mean, it's, I don't really know if people listening understand the difficulty of coming up with a new product sample in a couple weeks.
Going from like an idea to product in a month is absolutely insane.
It's just like, kind of unheard of. You have some really phenomenal competitive advantages and kind of blocked yourself in where, yeah, I mean, I don't know how someone's really going to compete with that either.
And speaking of like the competitive advantage side, like one thing that I've always thought was interesting, especially in this past year, is a million things have changed, right? Of course. There used to be like a huge emphasis on showing up in person, especially for business travel. And I'm not necessarily talking about China right now. I mean, like just in the US, right? Like the idea that I would fly across the country to go and have a business meeting with someone over in California used to be a very big notion. And I think now that everyone feels very comfortable in Zoom and teleconferencing and all that kind of stuff, like this idea that you have to go and show up in person isn't as big of a deal. And maybe I'm misreading that, but that's kind of been the sentiment that I've taken away from it. Now, in China, a lot of the time showing up in person is still a huge deal. Like, I know that we worked with our supplier for 2 or 3 years, did a ton of business with them, you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars, probably hundreds of thousands, like every single year with them. And I really don't think that it was like until we showed up in person that we started getting taken very seriously. And, you know, our order volume didn't necessarily change, but the way that they perceived us, treated us, and even like worked with us on terms and product designs and all that kind of stuff certainly did. Do you find that working over in China now, it's still as important to go and be in person and get that in-person relationship?
Yeah, now you hit the nail on the head. that was part of the frustration of it all when we first got started, was that we'd arrive in China and get more done in one day than we had gotten done in, you know, 3 months, right? There absolutely is that element to Chinese culture, Chinese work culture, where the meeting often happens like over tea. You don't even talk business for the first 95% of it. You're just getting to know each other, catching up and such. And then the last 5%, you sort of toss in some, you know, some business chat and such, and say, cool, like we'll work together and shake hands and such. As a result of me going through the Canspich program, I have a lot of Chinese mentors, and they've actually suggested that, you know, as long as we possibly can, continue to go back to China, not even for our third-party relationships, but for our own team as well. I think we can rely on them, and, you know, they can be accountable to us in sort of our day-to-day work, but it does completely change the dynamic whenever you're present there. And unfortunately, COVID is preventing us from doing that. If it wasn't for COVID, we'd probably still be going at least twice a year, Joel, the CEO, and I.
That's awesome. Nice.
Yeah.
So I want to try to take the last, Gio, do you have anything else specifically on Juniper? I guess one thing maybe is where you guys are at today in terms of size and scale. I think you mentioned $30 million last year. Do you have an idea as to where like you guys are expected to grow and be this year?
Yeah. So, as you said, did triple to 30 million last year, I think 31.
That's insane.
I'm blown away. It was insane. Thank you. The growth trajectory is continuing. We're looking, we have our sort of eyes set on doing 65 this year, by end of year, which would be fantastic as well. And scaling up the team, ideally not having to double the team size to get there and focusing more on process and technology, but you know, we'll see, who knows.
Phenomenal growth. Go ahead. Definitely some phenomenal growth there. I mean, still scaling at 100% at 30 million in volume.
We'll see what happens. We're quite confident just given the market direction, and the processes and team we're putting in place, that we'll be able to do 100 million plus in revenue in the next 18 months. So we're getting towards that overall. But have other sort of big ambitions for the business as well. and scaling out even further. But yeah, even the sort of today's model is super solid, and we're quite bullish and confident on getting that.
I want to take a second and kind of go back to some of the stuff we talked about last week, kind of before you really, you know, everyone always looks at you and like, oh, you're running a phenomenally successful company. You've scaled it out this far. But I think what a lot of people might be able to relate to is before you had seen any of this success, you kind of went through a pretty tough time, right? You know, trying to figure out what you wanted to do. And would you want to kind of discuss that maybe a little bit, and what helped you kind of pull you out of that depression and kind of refocus a little bit?
Yeah, no, totally. You know, maybe because I was building a 2D printer, but at some point, I think it was about 4 or 5 months after college ended, I went through a pretty serious depression for about 3-4 months and really, really struggled. There were, I think, a lot of reasons for that. Mostly, like, I was actually like a gold star student basically throughout university, and like never gave myself a break. So that in itself, I think, kind of crushed me. But yeah, I mean, I just super burned from that perspective. But yeah, I mean, you're just so naive when you're that young, like third, fourth year, you know? And I remember thinking like, wow, like my buddy did this. He started a business, right? And he's doing really well. Like, it's as simple as just going through this program and I'll be good, you know? And yeah, I found myself kind of at the end of the program with like a shitty printer business and nothing else to really show for it. We were sort of like, Juniper was, though the idea came like 4 months earlier, like we didn't really start doing much on it until sort of later in the year. And yeah, I just hit this like awful depression where I was essentially just bedridden for 3-4 months. It also didn't help, like, I was living with a buddy in a basement unit. It was a one bedroom too, so we just like alternated between sleeping on the bed or sleeping on the mattress by the door. So I think there were, you know, some obvious things I would change for next time, but it was just super tough. And I had my one of my mentors at the time really helped me through it, because he had gone through a very, very similar experience in his life. And he actually spoke to, I remember I just felt, super anxious, super depressed. And I was thinking about taking escitalopram, which is, a drug that can sort of, I guess, reduce the negative feelings you might feel during depression. And he said right off the bat, like, don't do that. Don't do that. And that's not to say that it can't work for many, many people. But what he spoke to was that, you know, the experience he had on it was that, sure, he didn't feel as bad anymore, but he never felt good anymore either. We sort of take like the sinusoidal, you know, way of life and kind of just make it a flat line, where nothing feels good anymore, nothing feels bad anymore. And he said it like he wouldn't wish that upon his worst enemies. And so I took that to heart too. Like I did dabble with it for a week or two, but didn't find much from it. And instead decided like, okay, well, I might as well feel it, you know, even if it's awful, I might as well feel it. But he also helped me sort of show me other things to think about as well. And I started incorporating my own stuff too. So first off, he said, with regards to work and productivity, like, don't worry about that. The focus right now is not to go and crush 10 hours a day of work. The focus right now is happiness in the long run. You're running a marathon, not a sprint, right? So like, just get through this time. And he suggested I like literally just put myself together every morning, go to campus at the time, work for an hour or two a day, and then go back home and just like feel very happy that like I was even able to do that, right? So something super digestible. He also suggested cold showers in the morning to kind of get the system up and running, and, you know, well invigorated and such. Meditation. It did. I mean, I took it too far sometimes and like stood in a cold shower for like 10 minutes, which I remember one day I literally just like went back to bed and stayed there all day.
You know what? I did the cold shower for today and we're going to try again tomorrow.
Exactly. But no, it was great. And like, by no means, you know, did I wake up every day and I'm like, I feel amazing, you know, but just like those baby steps and like getting the body feeling good again. working out and like maintaining a part of that was super helpful. And meditation too. Like I really started getting into meditation at the time. And yeah, just like practicing mindfulness and really feeling and understanding like, okay, this is why I'm feeling bad, or not up to par. And this is when I do feel good. And just even being mindful about it helped a ton for me to get through that.
Yeah, it sounds like there are a lot of like, there's just certain physical changes that you can make with your body, right? Like you literally just talked about working out, meditating, cold showers, right? Like these are things that literally change different chemicals in your brain that can change your mood. But it sounds like one of the bigger ones too was just small mental changes of literally taking pressure off yourself. I know that I can definitely be, that happens to me too from time to time where I'll put a ton of pressure on myself. Most of my daily to-do lists are in reality a two-day to-do list that I have this insane expectation that I think that I can go and do it in one day. And I got to imagine that a lot of people listening to this want to start a business or want to go and hustle and do something like big like that. And they think, hey, I have to go and work 12 hours a day to go and get this thing done. I kind of like your idea of no, go and get two really good hours. And they don't have to be really good hours, right? Like just 2 hours of solid work in. And finish for the day, right? Starting with baby steps instead of trying to go and totally overload your plate can probably get you to where you want to go in close to the same amount of time without all the negativity and stress that comes with it.
Totally, yeah.
Meditating and doing a lot of that stuff?
Not as much as I want to, but yeah, no. I mean, like whenever I literally have a list of things I do whenever I'm feeling off. You know, in the middle of a day. And, you know, first off, I just like ask myself, have I drank enough water today? Have I like slept enough? Have I eaten, you know, just like simple questions like that. And then if I find that I'm just like not getting anything done, I'll sit and meditate for a bit and think through it. And also just tell myself like, hey, if I need to finish early today, even if it's like 3 PM, I'm just feeling awful, you know, I'll just do it. You know, I've been doing this business now, my first one, for 4+ years, right? It's way, way more important for me to, you know, be able to consistently and sustainably work on it for months and years. And if I need to take a day off, I really try not to beat myself up for it. I still do sometimes, for sure, like far from perfect there, but yeah, I really try to sort of practice that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very well said. And also for anyone listening right now, I very clearly remember like 6 to 7 weeks ago, like it was almost 2 months ago, I want to say, I was having a terrible day. And you literally just hit the nail on the head where like, I realized it was like 5 p.m. and I drank no water that day. And like, you don't realize that you're dehydrated. It's just not a thing you really ever think about. So I go and drink 3 to 4 glasses of water. And like the next hour felt phenomenal. And I'm not saying that like water is this magic potion, right? I guess it keeps us alive. So it kind of is. But like, just think about that. Just do small things the other day that actually go and make you feel better, because you don't realize how much they help until you don't do them.
Yeah, I think in the same vein, like going for a walk outside is another really easy one that, you know, entirely changes your surroundings and you know, if you're in the forest, depending on where you are, in a city even, at least, you know, it's another one. Go walk for 20 minutes. You can really flip your mindset a good chunk.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say on this that really, really helped was I remember feeling alone at the time, like really, really alone. And part of that was probably because a lot of my like friends and colleagues had left the university town for work, and I was still kind of stuck in this university town trying to build. But I immediately just started like, well, not immediately, but I like quickly realized, okay, like to stop me from feeling alone anymore, I'm going to start just like really investing into my family, investing into my friendships, et cetera, which seems kind of obvious, or like, you know, could kind of ask like why I wasn't doing that before. But like my mom and dad, I'd maybe call like once a month back then, which was awful. So I started calling them at least weekly, and then, you know, sometimes calling them every couple of days, and same with my friends, like maybe not that often, but just like really started surrounding myself with the people that I loved and talking to them more and such. And just did wonders for me, just took me out of that mindset of like, I'm alone, no one cares, et cetera. And was, you know, able to remind myself that people did care.
That's awesome. I want to try to shift, you know, I know we don't have a ton of more time left, maybe 5 or 10 more minutes, if that works for you. But I want to kind of just shift to a few, like, what would you be doing today questions, and also what you want to do in the next couple of years and like where you really see yourself. So one question I always love asking, especially for people who are at the stage right now, right? Like you guys did 30 million last year, like next 18 months, you know, fingers crossed, a 9-figure company. Like that's pretty insane. Like I feel like you should be extremely proud and excited for that. But the question I always want to ask is like, okay, let's say that goes to zero today, because for the reality is, you know, the few thousand people that are going to be listening to this podcast is they have a company that's worth zero today. They don't have a company, right? And so they do want to go and start something. What interests you today that, you know, if you had to go and do it all over again and do something else today with no, you know, not really much money in the bank account, that you would want to go and spend a lot of time focusing on building and working on and turning into another, you know, 7, 8, 9-figure company?
So like what industries am I interested in, or just like how would I take that? How would I react basically if everything fell apart?
No, I would say more like what industries are you interested in? Like do you have like a certain business ideas that you find super interesting and that you think that you would want to spend a lot of your time working on?
Yeah, I mean, so yes, but yeah, like I'm far from undecided on which ones I would be working on. I think for me, like I would just continue to take that same approach that I took with when starting Juniper, was like take a look around me, see what I would be the best at creating based on my surroundings. And for like, I had my brother right there as sort of our first test client. And yeah, like start progressing with that direction in mind. I'm super bullish and excited about a lot of the work that obviously Elon Musk is doing and such. And in general, when I think about the like next business I want to build, even if Juniper is super successful, it's something that I would say is like a huge net positive on the world. You see a lot of very, very successful companies today, in particular, like, you know, Facebook and Google and such. And, you see that they are either like, you start to question maybe like what their morals are and even like what like positive impact they're having on the world and such. And there's a lot of things that they are doing that's fantastic, but there's a lot of things that are certainly questionable and such. And outside of even those big companies, I would like to find myself, you know, in a position where, I'm actually truly making some sort of impact. I'm not just finding and building some business model that fills some sort of gap in the market at that time, for the sake of, you know, rolling in dough and you know, growing something big, right? Really, I'd like to attach myself to something that, where I feel like I'm doing something that's really big and I can like be working on it for multiple decades. So a lot of what Elon is doing is I think the world I would like to play in as well. But understandably, I'd probably need to spend several years really studying that craft and understanding those industries before jumping into them. So do I have particular industries? Not as necessarily, but that's how I think about, you know, sort of what my next, honestly, the rest of my life would look like, I suppose.
So for anyone that can't see, you definitely have a huge set of books behind you that don't look too staged. What do you look towards, you know, for resources and knowledge? Are you clearly reading some books or podcasts, magazines, blogs, Twitter? Where do you kind of pull all this information from? I guess also how to like structure the company and grow it, and then also from a more just non-business side as well.
Yeah. First off, the books are completely staged. Yeah. I think I've only read like a quarter of them, to be honest. So I got to get through the rest. But I'm not actually a voracious reader, and I'm of either books or content online. And this is something else I've learned from Tim Ferriss himself, is really sort of taking a bit of a information diet, at least with regards to like reading online. For me, I really like figuring things out as I'm encountering those problems, right? So I think the concept is like just in time versus just in case information. And so we've decided to surround ourselves, Joel, my partner, and I, with a group of advisors, for example, at Juniper. We have 5 of them now that really kind of fill in these different gaps that we have because we're super young entrepreneurs. So we'll encounter a completely new problem we never have in the past, I'll go and try to figure out how to do it online, or we'll simply talk to these advisors and mentors and see like, hey, how did you guys do this in the past and such. So it's, yeah, like I'm not as well read as a lot of my peers in that sense, but I find that because I'm actually going through these problems myself, understanding the trials and tribulations of going through these problems and then researching how to actually fix it, I actually like arm myself with a set of tools that are, you know, useful for the rest of my life in that sense. So that's sort of my approach there.
It's kind of more the hands-on approach and diving into the deep end and hoping you don't drown. But I do like the concept of kind of surrounding yourself with, you know, the people that have done it before, or you know, someone that can give you guidance. How did you find, you know, those people? Was it, did you kind of make a conscious effort and pick specific people that would fit each one of these roles? Or just, you know, these ended up being acquaintances that you ran into and you know, you liked what they were doing and you asked them to help out?
Yeah, I mean, very, very different for each of them. But yeah, they didn't actually, it's funny. I don't think for any of them did we say, okay, we need an advisor or a mentor. We're going to go out and get this advisor and mentor. Which is funny because I think I haven't watched a lot of these YouTube videos in the past, but I think the Gary V's and stuff of the world are like, go get a mentor now, right? And I just, yeah. It just doesn't happen that way. You can't really message someone and say, hey, like, can you be my advisor? So one of them we met at a coffee shop randomly, which was super funny. So we were back in another small city in in Canada called Edmonton, and we're meeting for coffee with someone else entirely. And this like 45-year-old guy who kind of looked nerdy and weird kind of walked by and said like, hey, like I overheard you guys talking business, you know, what are you guys doing? Right. And we're like, oh man, one of these guys, you know, just the way he even said business was kind of funny. And you know, he asked us like, oh, what are you guys working on? And I think we kind of stuck our noses up a bit and said like, oh yeah, we've got a cool new startup. We were, you know, did a couple million in revenue last year. And we're like, so what are you doing? Right. And he's like, oh yeah, no, like I built this like mattress company. We did about 60 million last year. And I was like, whoa, okay. All right. This guy does know
his nose hits the ceiling, you know, it's so high. Yeah.
So just, yeah. And it was just so weird that he even came to ask us this, but yeah, he had founded that company, which did 60 million the year prior, and had also founded another company previously that today does almost a billion a year, which is just crazy in itself and weird that we find him in a place like that.
Can you say the company name? I don't know if we would know it or not, but
yeah. So goodmorning.com is the mattress company that he runs. And then Article, is the other company, that, you know, does close to 9-10 figures a year, I guess, or more. So yeah, wild stuff. But, yeah. And that's just one example of many, like the other advisor, that we found most recently, we actually, were looking for a new head of sales at the beginning of the year. And he was one of the candidates brought to us by an agency. But it was clear he was kind of like a level above what we would be able to ever fill for a head of sales. He was running his own sort of sales organization at another company. And so we kind of brought him through the recruitment process. And at the end of it, I think we both just said like, hey, like let's just do advisory stuff. Like this sounds like the better thing here. So I think the summary there is that like it, you never know where these guys will come from and where your mentors will come from, but we've made it a point to like really continue to invest in the relationships that we do have and that we really believe in. Our other mentor was actually like an old, he ran this program like 4, 5, 6 years ago that we went through. And you know, we had sort of like a passing relationship, but it was still powerful in its own way. And we asked him, you know, 5 years later to come and advise for us. So it really comes from anywhere and everywhere. Just keep your kind of eyes open for it and you'll find a match somewhere.
Yeah. And to that point too, I would definitely say like networking and mentors, probably two of the most important things that you can do in business. But when you treat them like like networking and trying to actively seek mentors, then they become two of like the worst things that you can do in business, right? I think the tough like magic about them is that the best ones happen organically and a little bit like, so like, you know, a random run into a coffee shop that later becomes a really great relationship. And it's really just tough to go and put yourself in those situations. The best thing you can really do is just like put yourself out there a lot. And honestly, like to your point, like just create cool things, right? I think that when you're creating and building interesting things, it naturally attracts people towards you that you want to go and work with and want to be advised from. And that's honestly probably the only secret I can think of to actually growing your network and finding interesting people to work with.
Maybe you should start a podcast where you interview really interesting 20-somethings.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, either way, Nikita, I want to be respectful of your time. And that was a lot from us. And while, you know, certainly forced networking is never a great thing, if people do want to reach out to you and talk to you and learn a little bit more about what you're up to with Juniper, where can people go and find you for today?
Yeah. So the company website is junipercreates.com. So please find us there. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Nikita Kapatoon, or my email, Nikita@hellojuniper.com. Happy to chat with anyone.
If you enjoyed today's episode, it would mean the world to us if you spent 5 seconds, took out your phone and opened up the Apple iTunes app to leave us a 5-star review on the podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening all the way to the end, and see you next week.